The Free Library of Philadelphia supports WHYY and presents Portlandia creator and Slater Kenny guitarist Carrie Brownstein on October 29th at the Merriam Theater. Brownstein will talk about her life, work, and new memoir, Hunger Makes Me a Modern Girl, with Saturday Night Live comedian A.D. Bryant. Event listing and ticket information is available at freelibrary.org/author-events. That's freelibrary.org/author-events.
What is going on with the Pennsylvania Supreme Court? I'm Shai Ben-Yaakov, in for Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. The Philadelphia mayor's race is the one getting all the attention here in the region, but the biggest race no one is watching is the contest for three, count them, three open seats on the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. It's the first time in more than three centuries that there have been three simultaneous vacancies. Two of those vacancies are due to scandal, and one sitting Supreme Court justice is under scrutiny for allegedly writing emails with racist and explicit content. Joining me now to discuss that is Duquesne University Associate Dean and Professor of Law, Bruce Ledowitz. Professor Ledowitz, thanks for speaking with me.
Well, thank you, Shai.
Okay, quick recap here on what Justice Michael Akin is alleged to have done. Tell us what happened.
Well, we don't know the facts, but allegedly he has exchanged emails of, as you said, explicit racist and sexist comment, and there doesn't seem to be much doubt that this is the case.
Now, yesterday, other members of the Supreme Court said they were disturbed by the emails, but I understand you're also disturbed by how they're being investigated. The court appointed a lawyer to look into this, and he said there was nothing inappropriate in the emails. Is the court allowed to look into their own conduct in this way?
Well, this is exactly the point. In 1993, a long time ago, the voters of Pennsylvania, after years of infighting on the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, adopted a constitutional amendment creating an independent system of judicial discipline with an investigative court, the Judicial Conduct Board, and a court of judicial discipline to decide the cases. The voters gave the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania only a limited role as an appellate court, and when the allegations involve a justice, it gave the court no role at all. But the Pennsylvania Supreme Court has never accepted the authority of that court and that system. This has been going on, as everyone knows, for over a year now, and already led to the resignation of one justice. The matter should have been thoroughly investigated and independently investigated last year, and now we're seeing the court try to take over the investigation a second time.
So I want to broaden this a little bit. We have one justice under investigation. Another, as you just said, Justice Seamus McCaffrey, he's resigned amid the same controversy. We got another justice, Justice Joan Ory Melvin, who a few years ago was suspended and charged with essentially using her court staff for political work. Is there some specific problem or lack of oversight of the court that's just giving rise to all this?
I'm afraid it comes from a culture of institutional arrogance, in which the court routinely oversteps the rule of law and oversteps its own boundaries. And the fact that they conduct their own investigations, even though the voters tried to limit them, is one example. Another example, undoubtedly one in which their actions were popular, is their suspension of the attorney general based on her misconduct and pending criminal charges. But they did not have the authority to do that either.
Now, voters will go to the polls next month and select three more justices. Do you have any faith that those judges can or should fix a system that in some ways seems broken?
There is no question that three justices on a seven-justice court is an enormous block. And if the candidates are asked specifically to make commitments, not these bland commitments I see in the television commercials, I'll bring back integrity to the court. No, specifically, will you agree to be bound by what the voters did and take the Pennsylvania Supreme Court out of judicial discipline? That's a commitment that a candidate can make. It's not talking about a case. It's talking about the administrative powers of the court. They're permitted to debate this. Let's have this debate. Let them answer the question. And I would like them to answer the question about the attorney general. Will you reopen that matter and look again and see whether there's any legal basis for the suspension? You know, whatever you think of Kane, and I don't think much of her, and I think she should have resigned, but whatever you think of her, she's entitled to due process, and she's entitled to be treated the way that anybody would be treated, any lawyer would be treated who was charged with a crime.
Well, I've been speaking with Bruce Ledwitz. He's professor of law and associate dean at Duquesne University. Professor Ledwitz, thanks so much.
Thank you, Sean.
Three months past the deadline, Democrats and Republicans are no closer to an agreement on a Pennsylvania budget. Major discord in Harrisburg surrounds the question of how to close the state's funding gap. But as WHYY's Mary Wilson reports, Republicans are raising the prospect of expanding gambling to find more money.
The possibility of legalizing new forms of gambling to prop up state revenues has simmered on a back burner for at least a year. It's getting more attention now as GOP lawmakers search for ways to fill a budget gap without ceding to the kind of tax increases Governor Tom Wolf supports. Wolf told Pittsburgh's KDKA AM this morning he'll consider a gambling expansion.
I haven't heard anybody say that is the end-all, be-all to our budget deficit.
Senate Republicans have said a plan to tweak casino regulations and allow online gambling could yield hundreds of millions of dollars. That could be a rosy estimate. A 2013 expansion of tavern gambling in Pennsylvania generated less than 1% of what lawmakers expected. Mary Wilson in Harrisburg.
More than 40 counties around the world have shale gas, but many are undecided about hydraulic fracturing. Fracking has made the U.S. the world's number one gas producer and a place where other countries can learn what works and what doesn't. The United Kingdom is debating whether to allow fracking. One English politician decided to do a little research of his own. Estate Impact Pennsylvania's Reed Fraser reports he did his field work in the Keystone State.
Inside a hotel just outside of Pittsburgh, Kevin Hollenrake is mingling.
Lovely to meet you, too.
Thank you very much.
Hollenrake is a member of the British Parliament. He's a conservative. He and his wife, Nikki, are in Butler County at the end of a four-day trek through Pennsylvania. They're about to tour the area with a parent group that's upset about fracking. But first, there's the little matter of giving out gifts from back home.
There's another one in the car. Now, these are fudge.
Oh! And
there's a partial ban on fracking in Great Britain right now. But one company has applied to frack for natural gas in Hollenrake's home district in northern England. He and Nikki have organized this tour of Pennsylvania to see fracking up close.
I mean, it was completely my idea that we came out here, and as a parent of, you know, we've obviously both parents of four children, so it's quite important that we get a safety angle on this.
Kevin Hollenrake is visiting with the Mars Parent Group. The group is trying to get frack sites pushed farther away from schools. The first stop on their tour is down the street from the local high school at a new gas processing plant. It's already being expanded.
The propane, the butane, all the other stuff that goes into tanks. And you can smell.
Pickup trucks come and go from the plant on a small country road. Hollenrake stands on the driveway of a suburban-style house that's now right across the street from what's essentially a small refinery.
Well, as I said before, we came here. I want to know which questions to ask.
Right.
And this is a huge question.
Yeah. Where would you put this?
I've no idea.
Yeah.
Not near my house.
Yeah.
Hollenrake says his district in England is similar to Pennsylvania, a mix of agriculture, tourism, and industry. He wanted to tour the state because he sees it as a kind of laboratory for fracking.
I think we wanted to be able to say to the people in the UK, in our constituency, is we tried to see the worst of it as well as hear the best of it. So, and I think what I've seen in Pennsylvania, you've seen certainly the worst of it.
That may be hard to hear, but Pennsylvania has felt environmental impacts from the shale gas boom. Before today, Hollenrake visited Dimmock, where a state investigation found more than a dozen water wells were contaminated from gas drilling. He also met with the Marcellus Shale Coalition, an industry group, and with the State Department of Environmental Protection. He says state regulators admit mistakes were made.
Well, I think we got a degree of honesty. I think they certainly accepted that things had gone wrong, that they were wet behind the ears when this all first started, and they've learnt an awful lot, and they didn't have the number of people on the ground. It sounds almost like the Wild West here when fracking started in 2008.
Hollenrake says what shocked him the most is that in Pennsylvania, people generally don't get much say in deciding whether companies can drill near their homes. He says it's not like that in England, where local planning boards are required to consider how new industries will impact people and neighborhoods.
And to look at factors about noise about light pollution, about traffic on people's lives. That doesn't seem to be forming part of the analysis about a permit, which I find incredible.
On Hollenrake's final tour stop, the parent group takes him to a dairy farm where crews are installing a pipeline. They want him to understand that once fracking starts, pipelines are the next step in creating a natural gas economy. They worry about the risks, but he says those risks aren't unique to fracking.
You have to think about the radius that could be potentially impacted by a pipeline rupture or explosion.
You could say that about conventional gas, couldn't you? And we do rely on gas. We do need. There's always going to be a compromise somewhere along the line.
He's sympathetic to these parents, but he also sees a benefit for his country in shale gas.
In the past, we have undertaken large engineering projects and things that have taken our economies forward over the last hundreds of years. And if we just waited every time until we established there'd be no risk, we probably wouldn't have done anything.
At the end of the tour, Hollenrake gets back into his rental car. He has a flight to catch back to England, and he's got a lot to think about. I'm Reed Frazier, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
In today's headlines, the union representing 2,800 janitors throughout Philadelphia has voted to authorize a strike as they fight with building operators over a new contract. The janitors of SEIU's Local 32BJ are being asked to pay more out of pocket for their health insurance. The building's owners want to freeze current pensions and eliminate them altogether for new hires. The janitors say they'll strike on Friday morning if a deal isn't struck before their contract runs out on Thursday. Princeton University public safety officers will soon have access to rifles to use in campus emergencies involving active shooters or armed suspects. The officers currently do not carry guns while on duty. The Princeton Police Department responds to incidents involving an armed suspect or active shooter, with the campus public safety department providing support as needed. Well, the WHYY forecast tonight, clearing skies, low of 53 degrees. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy, 69 degrees the high. And for Thursday, sunny, high up to 67. Friday, afternoon showers with a high of 63 degrees. Right now, 72 in Center City at 818. Still ahead, what's behind an apparent rift between black and white feminists?
I am a little taken aback at how stringent and how unforgiving certain feminists are.
That's coming up as NewsWorks Tonight continues.
Rutgers University in Camden supports WHYY and is hosting an open house for graduate programs from 5 to 8 p.m. Wednesday, October 21st. Rutgers Camden offers 28 graduate programs, including MBA, law, nursing, public affairs, computational biology, creative writing, criminal justice, and more. Details about the Rutgers Camden graduate open house on Wednesday, October 21st, online at camden.rutgers.edu/grad open house or 856-225-6104.
Virtua proudly supports WHYY. This is the time of year to sign up for health insurance. When choosing a health insurance plan, it's important to know whether your doctor or hospital is included. If you want to use a Virtua physician, hospital, or outpatient service, you can find out if Virtua is in the plan you're considering by calling 888-VIRTUA-3. That's 888-VIRTUA-3. Virtua proudly supports WHYY.
New Jersey's Clean Energy Program proudly supports WHYY. New Jersey's Clean Energy Program, incentivizing businesses, local governments, schools, and residents to integrate energy-efficient and renewable technologies into their new construction projects, existing building upgrades, and new equipment installation. More information about modernizing in your home and business with support from New Jersey's Clean Energy Program at njcleanenergy.com/WHYY.
Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Shai Ben-Yaakov. Dave Heller is off this evening. What makes for an ideal city? Jobs, of course, but also good schools, low cost of living, and an arts and culture scene. Some would say that sounds like a college town. In Pennsylvania, both State College and Pittsburgh are refashioning themselves to appeal to the knowledge economy. Keystone Crossroads' Eleanor Klibanoff has more.
Vidion is an audiovisual technology company, so marketing director Rebecca London says it just makes sense that they would want to test their products in the office.
We've got a really nice little theater area here, which is a fun place to show off the high-tech stuff that we do and also bring our kids in and have birthday parties.
Vidion has taken a standard office park building and turned it into an employee's dream. Dogs wander around the cool stone desks, and you can look out the wall of windows in the cafeteria while enjoying your free lunch. Plus,
we're in what's now the game room, pool table, pinball, foosball, kegerator.
Vidion's offices may scream Silicon Valley, but their zip code says State College, a university town far from highway intersections, railroads, or a river.
Older cities, they would locate on a river, and the river would power the paddle wheel, and the paddle wheel would make the electricity, and off went the factories.
CEO Todd Eardley says it's 2015. His tech company doesn't need a paddle wheel or a factory.
Our river is talent. Our river is intellectual capital coming from Penn State.
Positioning your company near a university makes sense in the modern knowledge economy, and communities are competing to appeal to this market. You've got State College, a university town trying to break out of the 18 to 22 age bubble, and Pittsburgh capitalizing on the college culture around Carnegie Mellon and the University of Pittsburgh. David Miller of the Center for Metropolitan Studies says Pittsburgh is attracting and retaining that intellectual capital from the universities.
More of those students and those younger individuals are selecting to stay in Pittsburgh, and much of that retention is because there are available jobs, many of which are generated by the ed and med sector.
The universities have always been in Pittsburgh, but they're beginning to play a larger role in the city's economy.
The University of Pittsburgh had as many students when the city was twice the size that it is than it has now.
People affiliated with the universities make up a larger percentage of the population than ever before, giving Pittsburgh some of those add-on effects of a college town. Higher education levels, more job opportunities, and a bigger arts and culture scene. Scott Shapiro, an aide in the mayor's office in Lexington, Kentucky, has created a term for college towns that appeal to private industry and postgrads: university cities. He discovered this while researching cities that resembled Lexington, home of the University of Kentucky and a big IBM office.
Back in the late 50s, IBM made a big bet on Lexington. Lexington was a college town, very agricultural, and was a sort of a sleepy town.
IBM was attracted to the river of young talent coming out of the university, and the employees were attracted to the college town atmosphere. Shapiro has identified 7 university cities in the country, including Ann Arbor, with the University of Michigan and a Google outpost, and Lincoln, home of the University of Nebraska and the so-called Silicon Prairie. There are a lot of people who'd like to see State College join that list. Courtney Hardin, communications manager for the borough, is one of those people, though she admits it would take careful planning.
The townships that are surrounding us have been very clear on the fact that they want to protect farmland. So if we're going to grow, it's going to be probably in height or density.
For State College to become a true university city, there would need to be some big conversations, like vision for the town and relationship to the university, as well as countless small ones as well, like where to put the kegerator. Eleanor Klibanoff, Keystone Crossroads.
Keystone Crossroads is a statewide public media initiative reporting on the challenges facing Pennsylvania cities. WHYY leads the 4-station partnership. Last week, social media buzzed with backlash against the upcoming historical film Suffragette. Black feminists objected to a publicity photo of the film's stars, including Meryl Streep, wearing T-shirts that read, "I'd rather be a rebel than a slave." The quotation is from Emmeline Pankhurst, a British suffragette portrayed in the film by Streep. Joan Morgan writes about feminism, race, and popular culture. James Peterson, host of the WHYY podcast The Remix, asked Morgan what's behind the rift between white feminists and black feminists.
So I think that what happens that gets read as this ongoing tension between black feminists and white feminists, which has always existed, is really the historic tensions between black women and white women, period.
Even outside of feminism.
Yeah. Around beauty, around entitlement, around privilege. There are ways that gets talked about in terms of black men and white men, but we don't really talk about it with, like, black women and white women. The stuff we don't talk about has to do with race. It has to do with sex. It has to do with attractiveness or who's seen as desirable. There's a lot feeding under that. But, you know, it tends to get the most shine when the feminists go at each other. And part of the reason that the feminists go at each other is that white feminists won't touch that with a 10-foot pole. And actually, I don't know that black women really want to always touch it either because it's painful.
Is that misdirected focus? I mean, because that's like a solidarity question in some ways. Obviously, the tensions and the arguments and especially the social media stuff is going to get a lot of attention. Is that even something that, from your perspective, should be center stage in terms of thinking about 21st century feminist movements? I mean, should it be more about equality for women, you know, equal pay, you know, access to healthcare, you know, all? Should it focus more on the sort of logistics and the social justice issues relevant to feminism or womanism? Or is this piece like an important component for us to have as a part of those conversations?
Well, it's the truth. You know what I mean? It's like you cannot come together and form interracial coalitions to fight for justice and then have this big underlying with each other that you don't talk about. You know what I mean? Like, it just doesn't work. And I think part of it is, you know, part of black women's frustration is that is a very white feminist tactic. It's like, does it always have to be about race? Can't we get past the race thing? We're all women. We're all suffering. But yeah, we are. But you know what? We're not suffering in the same way.
Right. Joan, thank you so much for joining me today.
That's James Peterson talking with journalist Joan Morgan. You can hear more of the conversation and conversations with people driving current opinions, news, and cultural movements on the Remix podcast at whyy.org/remix. Finally, a follow-up to a story we brought you last week. The folks who care for Lucy the Elephant, the six-story wood and tin tourist attraction just outside Atlantic City, have rejected an offer from People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals to fund part of Lucy's restoration. Well, in exchange for their donation, PETA wanted to decorate Lucy to, quote, educate visitors about the grim lives facing elephants in circuses. That would have included shackling one of her feet and affixing a teardrop below one eye. Richard Helfand, head of the attractions board, says Lucy must always be a happy place for children to visit. And just to be clear, PETA offered a mere $2,000 toward the $58,000 cost of renovation. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by myself and Kimberly Haas. Dave Heller is back tomorrow. Find us on iTunes or listen at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Shai Ben-Yaakov for NewsWorks Tonight.
Abington Friends School, an independent Quaker school for students preschool through grade 12, supports WHYY. A child-centered lower school program nurtures joy and love of learning in both indoor and outdoor spaces. With math and language arts specialists in every classroom and a team of science and arts teachers, students are supported, challenged, and inspired every step of the way. Registration for their open house Saturday, October 17th at 1 p.m. at abingtonfriends.net.
The Boyer College of Music and Dance at Temple University supports WHYY and presents the Temple University Symphony Orchestra's inaugural concert under new music director Maestro Andreas Delfs. Maestro Delfs has worked with Yo-Yo Ma, Joshua Bell, Emmanuel Ax, and Renee Fleming. The concert, featuring works by Adams, Kearns, Sierra, and Stravinsky, is October 15th at 7:30 p.m. at the Temple Performing Arts Center. Information at temple.edu/Boyer.